Hello, this is Ted Skull, co-founder of Corky Cruise. This time around, we're going to talk about some of the roughest cruising regions around the world, so that when you're looking to plan an itinerary, that you take into consideration what the weather might be like. And you might look at forecasts once in a while while you're researching where you want to go, and I'm going to give you some tips on the subject right now. Now, for small ship cruising, it's not always fair winds and calm seas. Some parts of the world seem more chopped than others. And to be in the know before booking, here are the regions that have a bit of a reputation. So let's begin with the good news. Advanced weather forecasts give ship captains ample warning today, that is, and in the last probably a couple of decades, to be able to steer clear of a hurricane's track by altering course. A diversion may result in skipping a port or two and substituting others. And while you might feel the swell from the storm, it is unlikely that the ship's movement will be more than just a gentle rise and fall. Now, stabilizers are those fins that come out from the hull of the ship below the waterline, and they move up and down in order to counteract the motions of rolling from side to side. Now, they don't have any effect on the pitching, which is the bow and the stern going up and down, but they do a lot of eliminating the roll of a ship. The smaller the ship is, the less likely you'll actually have stabilizing fins, so you need to take that into consideration too. Large cruise ships have massive bows that tend to slam into head seas, and to lessen an unpleasant situation, the captain may have to drastically reduce his speed to lessen the impact on the hulls. Cruise ships are not designed to go fast through all different kinds of weathers. They're to give you the maximum amount of space and a good ride. So they don't want to put too much pressure on the ship by slamming into the seas and make it very unpleasant for you on board. The old liners would have more strengthened hulls because they would be expected to maintain speed in most types of weather, if not the hurricanes and gales, particularly the North Atlantic. The Queen Mary II is a good example of extremely well-built ship that is designed to handle all types of weather. And I've been on it a number of times, and very often they will slow down slamming into seas just because it is an unpleasant sensation. It's not so much the movement, but it's an unpleasant sensation. Now we're going to look at the Caribbean first. It has its hurricane season, roughly June to October. Could go a little bit more in the beginning and last a little bit longer in the end, but that's generally where they are. And it is probably tops in the list in terms of the numbers of people potentially affected because of the large number of ships cruising there in the amongst the Caribbean islands. However, with so many alternative routes and ports of call, in most instances, ships can avoid the storm's fury and still provide a satisfying cruise. The North Atlantic Ocean is notorious for its storms at almost any time of the year. And the further north the track, that is traveling from, let's say, the United States and Canada over to Northern Europe, the more likely it is to encounter some rough seas, especially between the multi-island passage. If you go really far north, for instance, of Scotland, past Orkney and Shetland, the Faroes, Iceland, come dipping below Greenland, past Newfoundland, and then into the Canadian provinces or down to the East Coast. That is a track of a lot of ships, and there can be rough weather there. It's also a positive thinking when you're talking about islands, that islands do have a lee side. So if the wind is hitting the west side of the island, if you're on the east side of the island, you're less likely to feel the movement created by the storm on the other side. Ships that season, reposition seasonally between the Atlantic, via the Atlantic from, let's say, Northern Europe to the Caribbean and Florida, will possibly encounter some storms, but a little more so. Less so would be if you're sailing from the Mediterranean and Iberia to the Caribbean and Florida. You are less likely altogether to create much in the way of storm. So it's usually a nice passage to have. Now, one passage that gets a lot of play is the so-called Bay of Biscay, which is a passage that you take if you were sailing between Northern European ports and Iberia, Spain that is, and possibly calling at some north coast ports in Spain and then going around past Spain and Portugal into the Mediterranean. And that body of water west of France and north of Spain has a long anecdotal history, especially with Brits. I've made 16 passages between England and northern Spain, Santander, and one time only was it truly tempestuous, and that was enough for everybody on board, including me, who likes a bit of a chop. The Mediterranean is an interesting body of water. The Mistral is a wind that comes from the north down the Rhone Valley in France. So it comes from Northern Europe down the Rhone Valley in France and then across the Western Mediterranean. That usually happens in the winter and spring that you get a heavy wind from the north. It did happen once when I was on board the Royal Clipper of Star Clippers during a very powerful Mistral. And the captain decided, the vessel was fairly new, to see if he could reach the ship's maximum hull speed. In other words, the fastest it could go through the water that the ship was designed to do. And so he put up all the sails that he felt was safe to do, and we really did move fast, up to around 15 knots, I think. So it's been a while, so I might be off a little bit. But it was really quite exhilarating, and he had the most marvelous, satisfied face when I looked at him holding the wheel with all the sails billowed out and the ship just roaring through the seas. It was really exhilarating and a bit more than just a bit dramatic. Now, the Drake Passage latterly has gotten a lot of press simply because Antarctica is not a place that people have gone to over the decades. I mean, really, Antarctic tourism is 20 or 30 years old, although I know people went earlier. The mass of people are going where in the last couple of decades. And the Drake Passage is that water that runs east and west between Ushuaia, Argentina, which is the tip of South America, and the Arctic Peninsula below that. It has a very well-deserved reputation. And happily, any kind of a storm that might occur only lasts maybe 12 hours at the most for what is a slightly longer than a day and a half passage. So if you're susceptible to mal de mer, be prepared to deal with any eventuality because the expedition that you're going to experience is well worth it. Now, longer itineraries often include the Falklands, which are east of Argentina, just east, and South Georgia, which is part way between South America and South Africa. Your chances for stormy weather there are a good deal more, and that is a fairly long passage between the Falklands and South Georgia, is about 2 days each way, plus the time that you spend at the South Georgia island. So that is more than likely to be rougher than the actual Drake Passage, which is the north-south passage. Now, the inside passage to Alaska is well protected, and that's the passage that runs from Vancouver and Seattle up to the east of Vancouver Island, with British Columbia coast on the starboard side, up to the top of the Inside Passage, and then it opens up into the Gulf of Alaska and ends in the area below Anchorage, towns like Seward and Gordova. You can get open sea stretches there, and that's having been subjected to weather that has come across and waves that have come across from Japan all the way across the North Pacific, so that could be quite rough. Just the Gulf of Alaska. Now in Asia, Southeast and Southeast Asia, typhoons are an occasional worry in that part of the world. In the North China Sea and the South China Sea, upwards past China, Hong Kong, South Korea, and Japan. But you can make course alterations and minimize the discomfort unless the ship is heading to a disembarkation port, in which case they may have to slow down the arrival until the waters calm down or arrive a little bit late. But that doesn't happen very often. Now, the Trans-Tasman Passage is between Australia and New Zealand, which is made up of two major islands. And that is a passage of about a day and a half, and that can be rough. And then the Bass Strait can definitely be rough. It's a more narrow passage between Southeast Australia, below Sydney, south of Melbourne, and the island of Tasmania. And that's a fairly narrow passage if you look it up on the map, and you can get quite a bit of rough weather going through the Drake Passage from the west to the east. But it doesn't last terribly long. It'll be a matter of hours, not longer than that. Now, closer to home, if you're a Yank, would be an area around Point Judith. And this is a place that is part of Rhode Island on the western side of Narragansett Bay, as Long Island Sound, Narragansett Bay, and the Atlantic Ocean meet. And there are all sorts of currents, and you can actually see them if you look over the side, coming together in some cases, depending on which way the sea is running and the tides are running and the wind is causing the waves to go. And it's the only time in my life that I've ever felt seasick. And interestingly, this has had a very long history of being a rough place. It doesn't last very long, maybe 20 minutes, a half hour at the most. But if you read the old books about the overnight passage between New York and Newport or Fall River or Providence or Boston, the boats would have to go past Point Judith, and that was where the ships would rock. They were big side wheel ships, and they could be bouncing around quite a bit. Now, the small ship I was on was only about 100 feet long, but it was a small cruise ship. And I was standing at the stern going up and down, and that was the first time I ever thought I was going to be seasick. And what I did was I simply went to the center of the ship along the side on the port side and just stood there, and then I was halfway between the bow and the stern, and I, within a couple of minutes being out in the fresh air, it disappeared. Now, that's not going to work for everybody necessarily, but it worked for me. So I didn't actually get seasick, to break my record. Now, historically, Charles Darwin was more seasick than not when he made his 3-year passage on the Beagle. Back then, of course, there were very few remedies, and today there are many. And it's a truism that everybody reacts differently, so there's really no easy answer. But only a small percentage do experience mal de mer, and if you do, it's really no picnic. If you had it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So you need to get some preparation before you go, if you're not a regular cruiser, especially if you're going into rough weathers or maybe on a very small ship. I've known people who have gone through all sorts of storms on big liners and big cruise ships and so on, and then have gotten on somebody's one-masted sailboat and sailed around New England waters and gotten very seasick. So you never really know. It's a very individual thing. So professional help would be your doctor or the nurse or possibly of the local drugstore if they can give you some advice of what to prepare for so you have something with you. And very often on board there are tablets or shots that you can get. On the bigger ships, there's shots that you can get, and that usually works. The shots sometimes knock you out for a while, and everybody has a different reaction how much you get knocked out. But I wouldn't worry about it too much unless you've had bad experiences, and then just look at the itineraries and read a little bit about them and see whether this is a good time of the year to go, and you will then have the information you need to decide whether to go or not. And I hope you do go, and I hope you have fair winds and calm seas.